Okay, thank you. The title is a little non-specific because I'm planning to talk about several possibilities in which we could make sense of such an event where there was possibly something before the Big Bang which was non-singular, and the question is what it was, so it's left open here. It might have been something semi-classical in the strict sense of a bounce, or it might have been another more quantum state which we would still evolve into in a non-singular way, but which we may not be able to interpret in a semi-classical geometrical way as the part of the universe that we can see. So the main basis is discrete geometry. So in new quantum gravity, there's a well-defined prescription, a formalism by which we can compute geometrical operators, and they turn out to have discrete spectra. If we then look at the dynamical evolution, which is given by the Hamiltonian constraint, which is difficult in general but can be done more specifically in loop quantum cosmology, then we can see that that gives rise to difference equations because of the discreteness rather than differential equations as you would have them classically or in a Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. That is the basic implication of the quantization, and it has several consequences. So these difference equations certainly are or imply that the dynamics is not exactly the same as we would expect it from a usual Wheeler-DeWitt quantization, because it's a different type of equation. And there are some cases where this altered dynamics can be interpreted as repulsion effects on wave packets. So that is what Abai, for instance, discussed in his talk. If you look at wave packets which start out semi-classically and then evolve backwards to smaller volume, then they bounce and avoid the singularity. In that case, one really has an effective picture of geometry throughout, so that's why we can talk of a bounce and assign a volume, or at least an expectation value for volume, which is rather sharply defined all the time, and that gives us an effective trajectory for the bounce. Although certainly the dynamics is not the one that we have classically, because otherwise it would be singular.
Is the fact that you get difference equations, does that follow immediately from the fact that the basic variables are spin networks, or is there some other ingredient like non-separability
and no, I'm actually going to discuss that in more detail in the next slide, so that's just motivation here. So that was the first possibility which has been seen in some models so far. But the second possibility that states generically really enter the deep quantum regime, and that would imply that we would not be able, at least not so easily, to speak of a bounce. It seems to be a more general situation as non-singular evolution of quantum states, although it does not directly give us any geometrical intuition of what's really happening, because it is such a deep quantum regime rather than something semi-classical or at least effectively related to some average geometry. That's also based on difference equations, and as I will also explain in more detail the basic effect here, that we look at these difference equations and study the recurrence scheme that they define. That turns out to be well posed, even around classical singularities. So these are difference equations on superspaces, and we have certain submanifolds of these superspaces, in the simplest case, just zero volume if it's isotropic, on which the geometry classically would be singular. Then we can study the recurrence scheme of these difference equations around these singular submanifolds, and they turn out to be still well posed in the models that that have been studied. So that's a second mechanism of non-singular behavior, which doesn't refer directly to a geometrical picture, but which can also be made well defined based on these difference equations. So all this is so far not a general mechanism. So we have studied examples, quite a few, especially in the second case, which also include anisotropic models and inhomogeneities. But certainly it's still one still has to go further and make it as general as possible. Since the BKL scenario has been discussed here, it's not so easy, I think, to use it. One can certainly use it as a motivation, but in the first case, where we have bounces, it may be difficult to refer to the BKL behavior because that uses asymptotic arguments, and just by the fact that you have a bounce, you may avoid these asymptotic regions in which the arguments are valid. Or if that is to be used, then one has to study that in much more detail and see at which scales these statements become reliable. Also, in the second case, it's not so easy. We might not have a bounce. We might really go into a deep quantum regime. But it's a very different situation now because we are studying difference equations on superspaces, and that is certainly not the same as Einstein's equations. And also here, one cannot directly refer to the BKL scenario. Now, so that brings me to the plan of this talk. In the first part, I will, as I said, discuss in more detail the origin of these difference equations and what really goes into the fact that we have difference equations. Then also illustrate it in the simplest case of isotropy for the second mechanism here. And after that, the first mechanism can also be seen quite easily in isotropic models, in which I discuss a solvable model that describes the bounce, and also, not really in detail, but I'll mention the relation to effective equations that have been shown here. And then in the final part, if I have time, I will give a few examples of these generalizations that have been done to anisotropies and inhomogeneities, and also mention in which sense it is possible so far to address this BKL question, whether or not one can use similar arguments at the quantum level. So the way that I will introduce the difference equations is mainly based on isotropic models, just to simplify the expressions. In this case, the connection is just has a single free variable, which is this coefficient C tilde here. Otherwise, it can be just chosen by gauge to be proportional to the identity. And similarly, the densitized triad has another independent coefficient and is proportional to the identity. And those two coefficients are canonically conjugate, as they are also in the full theory. In this case, since it describes an isotropic model, the relation or the meaning of these variables, it's more intuitive in the relation to the scale factor. So P is basically the scale factor squared, and C tilde the time derivative of the scale factor. Gamma is the university parameter, which I keep here, but it's not really important for what I'm going to say. So it certainly has the same information that we have in the scale factor and its time derivative. But there's one point which will become important later on, which is that the densitized triad can have two different orientations. And that means that this coefficient here can be positive or negative, which is not contained in the information that we just get from the scale factor. So there's an additional sign factor here that we automatically have by using these densitized triad variables in which the...
So there are more degrees of freedom beyond just the scale factor, right?
It's isotropic, so you.
Quantum correction comes with higher modes, and one place where higher modes would matter.
Well, yeah, that is just a classical model. So just to illustrate the geometry, and then later on there will be quantum corrections, and in effective equations you can see that there could also be additional terms that you would expect otherwise. But that's not included in the classical part, and also it's not used to quantize a theory. It will come out later if you derive effective equations, but it's not contained in the basic algebra that we use for the quantization. That's the main thing that I'm going to discuss now. So we already saw that in the full theory we use graphs, So these are functionals on the space of connections, which depend on the connection through holonomy. So for each edge in the graph, one takes a holonomy and then multiplies them in a certain way to get a function, which is usually gauge invariant. So states are functionals of these expressions, which are holonomies along all the edges that are contained in the graph. Now, in this symmetric situation, it's sufficient to restrict ourselves to just edges along symmetry generators of our of some homogeneity group, for instance. So that can be used to choose a graph which is regular, cubic, and the edges are just along the symmetry generators. That simplifies the expressions because we can directly evaluate these holonomies. So we don't need to consider the path ordering because it's homogeneous. And then we just get a cosine of that integrated connection component, a sine and Pauli matrices.
Is the zone of this Pauli matrix contracted loose or something, or is it just tau I?
It shouldn't be the same index. So for each, it depends on the direction because we choose a gauge here, an SU2 gauge, which implies that it's
normal vector or something.
Yeah. Right. So that with the vector field that generates this particular direction. Yeah, I forgot this here.
Can I ask just a remedial question? I should have paid more attention to Thomas's talk. But is the choice of this lattice basically, or the graph, is it arbitrary? Or what? How do you think of
it? At this stage,
is it for any graph that you have studied and then have you map?
At this stage, it's arbitrary. So if you want to write a basis, you need to consider all graphs. Then if you implement diffeomorphism invariants, you only need to consider diffeomorphism classes of graphs. But still, the diffeomorphism class would be arbitrary at this stage because you're writing down a basis. So it's, you just want to have a basis of states on the space of all connections. And it's an infinite dimensional space, so you certainly need a large set of basis states to write all possible functions that you want to represent here.
But in this isotropic case, if you didn't start with a cubic lattice but had done something else, would it be equivalent or different in some sense?
Well, certainly the expressions would be more complicated to calculate.
You think the physics would be the same?
Yeah, is it known that the physics doesn't depend on which graph you start with?
Well, there might be details that change, but basically the graph is contained in these expressions, these integrations of the connection component, and that will change if you choose a different graph. But so you would pick a different basis basically, and a different basis that corresponds to your isotropic model from the reduction of the full theory, which is not symmetric. And so detailed coefficients might change, but and physics, as I'm going to describe it, and the physics that we discuss so far, would not change considerably. So if you would really look at details of quantum corrections to classical equations, for instance, that could depend on which graph we have. But
a physical question like what's the curvature at the bounds? The precise answer would depend on which graph you started with?
Yeah, the precise answer certainly, but
I'm sorry, I thought you were needed a different answer. I thought you would have told us that in your isotropic ansatz, the holonomy along any edge from any graph is in fact a function of the holonomy along the edges you chose. And therefore, that choosing a different graph amounts to describing the same theory with different variables and not changing the physics at all. That's not the case. It does change the physics.
Well, what certainly is also important is the length for the edges that you choose. So even if you just keep cubic graphs, but you rescale them, then your coefficients also it would still depend on these integrals, but if you express it in terms of as multiples of C or A dot in effective equations, then certainly it is important which coefficient you have for how long you are integrating along these edges. And that will also appear in these equations, in these effective equations.
And I think this is just to go along the answer. Here, the connections are just given of that certain type of that homogeneous entropy. And so what you want to know is, we want to write down enough functions of connections, which technically, mathematically, are called separate ones. In other words, if I know the values of these functions, then I know what the connection is. And if you just take the straight edges, then I know what the connection is. And therefore, as Don was saying, the Coulomb around any other edge is expressed already. If you know this Coulomb around along the edges of the homogeneity isotropic vector field, it's not a graph that is necessary, it's just which edges do you need. If I know these edges, then I know the connection. So otherwise, I'm just expressing the theory in terms of some other coordinates, right? Some other coordinates of phase space.
But then why should your final answer depend on this choice?
So I would think it should not depend on the shot, but I think we should just see it in detail.
Okay, yeah, and the exact isotropic model, it does not. It would depend if you include, because it's really not an isotropic situation. If you have a lattice state, then it also includes some perturbations around it. And for these perturbations, it does depend on the graph. But for the isotropic model, certainly, there's just a single degree of freedom. And it's just a huge redundance if we start with a full lattice, as we have it in the full theory, and then reduce it. But in the end, it's really just the dependence on the connection in this way through cosine and sine functions and not other function that you could imagine, which is important for the states. So, well, that's actually just a single holonomy, but then if we take a full state, we multiply all these holonomies together as the state would tell us, then we can, we would just multiply all these sines and cosines for all possible edges. We can take a trace to get a gauge invariant expression, for instance, and in the end, any such state can be just written as a product over all vertices and edges, over all edges in the graph, of exponentials of some coefficient which is related to the spin label, in which we take the holonomy, the SU2 representation that we took initially of that SU2 holonomy, and also, as in this basic expression for holonomies, the integrated connection component enters. So that's the expression that's obtained if we just take an arbitrary state and evaluate it on these isotropic connections. Now, if it's really isotropic, then these the integrations of C tilde are not really, they wouldn't depend on which edge we choose. So this is, would be the same number for all edges. It doesn't depend on V and I. It's just a single number which we can factor out here. And in the product, we'll just have the sum over all the labels mu that appear in this construction in the graph. So for exact isotropy, states that we need to consider are just of the simple form. So they are functions of the connection component in the connection representation, but not arbitrary functions. They are superpositions of these exponentials. And if we just take a single exponential in this form, then these states are orthonormal. That's also coming from the fact that we started with spin network states, which form an orthonormal basis of the full Hilbert space. And all the freedom that we initially had in choosing the graph and different labels, different spins for different edges, is contained in that single number, which we obtain by summing over all of them. So the reduced Hilbert space is indeed, as it should be, just a certain representation of functions on the space of connections. And the exact representation is given by this construction. So these states are orthonormal, they are normalized in particular. It's not the representation that we would usually expect from Schrödinger quantum mechanics. It's, for instance, non-separable if we mu can take real values. And also, the operators have different properties compared to a Schrödinger quantization or Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. So we need one operator for a connection component, and what's immediately represented are these exponentials. Since we write these states here in the connection representation, we just multiply them and add the label of the state and the label that we have in the operator, so that's the action here. The densitized triad is also quantized. It's conjugate to the connection, so it has an expression like this in the connection representation, and that's also easy to compute. So that looks...
So this gamma is just an emergency parameter?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's still there even in this isotropic limit. It's just a one parameter ambiguity in the theory, is that right?
Right, and yeah. So in that case, you can actually, if it's isotropic, they are actually unitary transformations at this level for these operators to to change gamma if you allow real values for mu, which we have in general if we keep ultra-side lattices. But it will, later on if we write down the Hamiltonian constraint operator, then the value of gamma will also be relevant. So the Hamiltonian constraint operator will not be fixed by the unitary transformation that would change gamma here. So it's slightly different from the full situation, but at least at this kinematical level. But then concerning how gamma appears in the constraint operator, the situation is the same as in the full theory, just simplify. So I keep it, and the later expressions will depend on which value we choose, but the statement that I'm going to make will be independent of the exact value. Again, it will just appear in coefficients. So if we compute effective equations, correction terms, then they will depend on gamma. But for statements about singularities as they have been made so far, the value of gamma is not important.
So like Ted's question of the maximum curvature of the bounds or something would be independent of gamma?
Oh, no, it's not independent of gamma because the Hamiltonian constraint is really used to determine the bound scale, and the Hamiltonian constraint does depend on gamma in a more sensitive way. But there are independent arguments to at least get the order of magnitude of gamma. So the order of magnitude of the curvature scale at the bounds, although it does depend on gamma, is something one can trust, even if the precise value of gamma would not be used. So,
can I your reference to a lattice and so forth is just a matter of convenience. You haven't introduced the fundamental discretization into the theory.
No.
Or fundamental length or anything.
No, we because in the full theory we have to use all lattices arbitrarily fine, and we cannot take a limit in which the spacing goes to zero. But
so there is a definite lattice.
No, well, I just wrote down one definite lattice, but you can do the construction for all possible lattices, so you can choose
it. It is fundamentally discrete.
Well, if you fix a state, then it's fundamentally discrete. But that is just picking a basis element in your Hilbert space. So the construction of the Hilbert space does not put in the discreteness. It only comes in at the level of state. So once you know a solution, for instance, a certain state or a superposition of states, then you could determine the discreteness by acting with operators. But the discreteness does not really enter here at the state level, but only when you consider dynamics. So right here you can also you can allow any real value of mu. So it is what I'm right. So it is discrete in the sense that P has a discrete spectrum, even if mu is real, because it's these eigenstates are always normalizable. And then the P operator does have a discrete spectrum.
But maybe one can say the discreteness is not by taking a lattice, dividing it
real line and lattice, but by introducing the discrete topology of the real line, which sort of disconnects the continuum of points. Mm-hmm. Which is also the basis of this non-separable Hilbert space.
David,
So I just had kind of a naive question about gamma. I mean, I thought there were all these loop quantum gravity calculations of black hole entropy. And assuming that they depend on gamma, presumably, you know, getting the Hawking answer fixes a value of gamma. So why don't we just say, you know, we know gamma and it has this value, and, you know, we're just using gamma as a shorthand for, you know, pi over 6 or whatever the hell it actually is.
So that's exactly what has been done, right? In the sense, the statement is that for the full theory, as Gary was saying, there is a one part of atomic ambiguity, and which is leaving it as it is. But then when it, and it is true that the curvature or the density at the bounce point depends on this gamma. In fact, it depends as the density depends upon gamma q, which is somewhat sensitive. But the numbers that I gave are all obtained doing exactly what you say. Namely, obtain the value for gamma, which came from black hole entropy, and we put it in. And there is a coherence, and this is what Martin was saying, that from our order of magnitudes, at least, if in fact the gamma was, you know, 10 times, then in fact the bounce would have occurred at a density which is 1,000th of the Planck density, as opposed to, or if it was, you know, 1/10, then it would occur as 1,000th of Planck density. So there is a sensitive dependence. But of course, if it was twice more, I mean, you know, we wouldn't be able to say very much. So exactly.
What okay, but so there is no ambiguity. There is a particular value, and, you know, we're just using it, whatever it is.
Do you know what it's supposed to be?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, from the black hole entropy calculation, you get the value for gamma. And then one can use it. But I mean, one can do it, say that, well, no, there's some other black hole entropy calculation. What is happening in quantum cosmology outside? Then gamma would be connect various branches, then I could just leave this as a parameter.
But independently of black holes, am I correct in saying that the gamma could be measured in principle? There's one value that characterizes our entire universe, and you can measure it, say,
well, since, yeah, the quantum corrections and effective equations would depend on gamma, so if you would be able to measure these correction terms, you could measure it, yeah.
Yeah, so just the number in the theory.
Right, yeah.
Even without a random black hole.
You can't identify gamma without understanding the relation between the bare parameters and the low energy and true black hole entropy, without understanding what the low energy effect of Newton constant to emerge from this theory is. And I don't think that's understood. So you.
No, I disagree with that. So this is a big discussion about the renormalization of group flows in the case of gravity and anything else. In gravity, it's an exceptional thing that happens, and then the rescaling of the momenta and the rescaling of the field coincide, and therefore we have two choices. We can use either the cutoff scale, which is what one uses in orthogonic field theories, or we can fix Planck's constant once and for all and use a Planck lens. And this whole subject is done with Planck lens. I mean, we can talk about, I mean, it's a subject that has been discussed, not by me, but by people like.
This isn't a choice of units, it's a physical effect that fluctuations, you know, between long distance scales and the Planck scales.
So we should discuss
a physical cumulative effect.
Yes, there's a detailed discussion, not by me, but by many other people, on the renormalization group flow in presence of it, including gravity, and why it is different from everything else. We should just discuss this.
So different topics.
Yeah.
Did you had a question?
Well, I'll just ask my usual question and then about it. So what's the cosmological constant here? You're now doing the quantum theory, so we have to worry about the quantum cosmological constant.
Yeah, the cosmological constant will enter in the Hamiltonian constraint, which is not written down yet. I will do it in one of the next transparencies.
So. Finally tune it in order to get this cosmically large space time to far past in the
Right, that's a dynamical statement, right? If you talk about past and future. So here, it's just about the basic kinematical representation. So just asking what the analogs of QNP in quantum mechanics would be. And then in the second step, you're going to write down a Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian constraint that will tell you what the dynamics is. And then at this stage, we will have the freedom of including lambda already in the from the classical expression. Or if we analyze the dynamics, then maybe conclude something about an effect of lambda, if that's possible. But maybe we should really come back to that when we see the Hamiltonian constraint. So now at this stage, we see that we get a certain representation here. It turns out to be an equivalent to the Wheeler-DeWitt representation. And the way that this representation arises is really related to what was discussed for the full theory, that there is a unique representation. Once you require that there is diffeomorphism covariance and you want to represent holonomies and these flux operators in the full theory, you get a unique representation. And that unique representation can be used to implement symmetry. I don't have enough time to go into details here, but that can be done. And for these lattice states, as I showed them, that induces these operators in the isotropic model. So that representation for the isotropic model, which we could just quantize by the Wheeler-DeWitt equation representation, is an equivalent. So these basic operators are very different. For instance, this one turns out to be not weakly continuous in this parameter mu prime. So it's not possible to take a derivative by mu prime and get an operator for C. It's only the exponential that's represented, only holonomies which are represented, but not the connection components themselves. So that's true in this representation, but certainly in a Wheeler-DeWitt representation, we would just quantize C directly. Also, the second operator behaves differently. It, as I mentioned already, it has a discrete spectrum because all these eigenstates are normalizable. That was related to the scale factor squared, and certainly in a Wheeler-DeWitt representation, that operator would also be different because the scale factor would have a continuous spectrum. So although the model itself is very simple, we see that this representation that we induce from the full theory in this way already has traces of the background-independent quantization that we did in the full theory, and that is distinguishable from property that we would have in the Wheeler-DeWitt representation. And that's the reason, the basic reason, essentially, why we get these difference equations rather than differential equations. And to derive these difference equations, we now have to look at the Hamiltonian constraint. That is the classical expression in the full theory without assuming symmetries. So we have these densitized triad components, the connection and the spin connection and the curvature of the connection. All these terms can be quantized, so that's what Thomas also described in more detail. These densitized triad components might be difficult because we would need to divide by the square root of the determinant, since these triad operators have discrete spectra and they contain zero, they don't have inverse operators, so that might be a difficulty. And Thomas also related that to ultraviolet divergences in the matter Hamiltonian that would be added to that gravitational contribution. The way to quantize it anyway is to use this equation, which is a classical identity. So on the right-hand side, we have some coefficients and this combination that we want to quantize. On the left-hand side, we have a Poisson bracket of connection components and just volume, which doesn't have any inverse of the densitized triad. So the left-hand side can be quantized. We can use holonomies for the connection components. We have a volume operator for this one, and the Poisson bracket would become a commutator divided by IH bar.
Is there a bare cosmological constant here?
Yeah, I didn't write it, but we could. And that would just have the volume as a coefficient, so that can straightforwardly be quantized.
But,
so I didn't.
So you're saying a second ago you'd have the UV effects of all these fields, including the ones that contribute to the Kalman-Fokker? I mean, that doesn't magically cancel out?
No. if you put in a cosmological constant classically and then quantize, it will be there in the quantum theory also. It might change, but we don't see any reason why it should tune to what we need for observations. So the next term would be these curvature components. That's also something that was already discussed. We can relate it to, again, holonomies now along closed loops, and then to leading order that reduces to these curvature components. The most difficult part is really this one, because it depends on the spin connection, and the spin connection is a complicated expression of these densitized triads. It's not really relevant for the symmetric model that I discussed, because there the spin connection simplifies. But also here, there's a general way to quantize. One can write this combination, which corresponds to extrinsic curvature, as a double commutator, using the first part here, volume and holonomy. So that can all be quantized. If we went through these two steps, we get a quantization for this object. Use a volume operator here, holonomy there, and in the end, that gives also a well-defined operator. So that's a way that this rather complicated expression is quantized. So we get an operator that uses only these basic quantities that we have, holonomies and fluxes, although in a rather complicated combination, of course, to express.
So it's really a triple commutator, because you still have to substitute
The
red expression in terms of this.
Right. But, this commutator, at least in the models, turns out to commute with the volume operator, so it still looked like a commutator, but you don't get any non-trivial terms from it, so you just change coefficients. But that's not really relevant. But strictly, if you just write in this way, certainly you get a Poisson bracket and a triple commutator.
Is delta a cutoff?
That depends on. It's not a cutoff. It depends on the state and on the way that the Hamiltonian constraint is quantized. So it's a quantization choice. It will appear in the relation, certainly, between these classical coefficients and these holonomies. So in the end, if you compute, again, effective equations, do a certain continuum limit in which you can re-obtain these classical fields, then this will depend on, these effective equations will depend on which choice you made precisely for the quantization of your operator.
Is it yet another parameter defining the theory?
Yeah, that's because we now have a rather complicated expression here, which has, and there are products of these canonical variables, for instance. So that quantization certainly has additional parameters. You have factor ordering, and you have other choices which determine the precise action. So again, the statements that I'm going to make don't depend on which choices we make here, but for precise calculations of effective equations, these terms would be relevant. So that's just a review of the general construction. Now, we can also apply this to these states that we had originally to get our isotropic reduction. And also here, although these equations look long, the end result simplifies because of the strong symmetry. So what we get is, if we follow these previous steps, is first of all a summation of all vertices in the lattice, because the classical constraint is an integration over space. Then we also summing over all triples of edges, because we need to pick two edges to for each loop here, and another edge which then combined with these connection components to give us another holonomy. And because of these epsilons, contributions are non-zero only if this edge that we use here is a perpendicular, it's transversal to the plaquette that we use for these curvature components. So that gives rise to the second sum here, and in the trace we have this holonomy around the loop that I mentioned. So now it is just as our state, a square loop using the symmetry generators. And there's this commutator here with another holonomy for the transversal edge and the volume operator, which comes from the Poisson bracket that we used in the first step to get these inverse densitized triad components. So just as a sketch, that's what the constraint operator looks like in general. And now we can, again, reduce this to isotropy. Well, I put reduced in quotes here because we don't have a completely well-defined procedure to start with any operator in the Fock theory and reduce it to isotropic states. But the properties that we obtain for that Hamiltonian in the representation of the isotropic model that I mentioned can be seen by this calculation. So we just formulate our loop here, this H alpha, in terms of holonomies along these straight edges that we use to construct states. So that's what I write here in this way. Well, the notation maybe takes some time to get used to, but the basic property here that we can now use these expressions for these holonomies in terms of just sines and cosines of the integrated connection component. So we can compute the trace explicitly, then also trace out all these Pauli matrices that occur in these coefficients of holonomies, and that's the result. So we get a certain combination of these cosines and sines, which I just call C and S to keep it shorter. And we get additional operators A and B, which come from these commutators.
What's epsilon? Just the usual epsilon symbol? Or?
Yeah, because there was already an epsilon in this one, in the classical constraint.
Epsilon squared is just one?
Or it can also be zero, and that's why I still keep it, because it just means that you have different I, j, and k, and we don't worry about the sign, but we need to know when it is zero. So that would be the expression if we just take such a cubic lattice state, but do not implement yet that it's homogeneous and isotropic. If it is homogeneous and isotropic, then these different cosines for different edges in this loop are all identical, and also sines are identical. In this case, the simplification really appears. So we just get a single term. This coefficient of A vanishes, and the coefficient of B reduces to a single sine squared of a certain number delta, which is related to the edge lengths, because we were integrating these connection components along edges. So there's a cosine, a sine, another sine, and a cosine here, so that we had a factor of 1/2 in each argument. So in the end, that all combines to a sine squared of just delta C without the 1/2. The B operator also simplifies, and there's this delta to the minus 3 outside, because we are summing over all vertices. And if you imagine that this lattice is in a box of a certain size, then the number of vertices is proportional to the edge length to the minus 3. So since the contribution for each vertex is the same, we have to multiply what we get for a single vertex here with this number, and then there are certain coefficients which I'm not worrying about here. So that is the operator that we get. We get a product of a sine squared of C, which we can, which is represented by these shift operators. We get an operator for B related to the commutator, which one can also compute since we know the volume operator through the P operators in this model. So that has a well-defined action that I'm going to show you on the next slide. And one can check that it does have the correct classical limit, which is obtained if C is small, because that's just extrinsic curvature in this model. So in the classical situation, extrinsic curvature would be small. Then we can expand this in C. We get just minus C squared if one looks at this B operator in more detail, that will reduce to just the square root of P, or really the absolute value, since P could be negative. And that's exactly what we have for the Friedmann equation, or in the classical constraint. C tilde was related to A dot, just proportional, so that would be A dot squared, as we have it in the classical constraint. And that the square root here would just be a single factor of the scale factor. So that reproduces the correct part of the classical constraint, and then the correct part of the Friedmann equation, which is just the classical constraint. But there are quantum corrections if we use the full operator, and especially if we go to small volume or large curvature scales, then these corrections are important. So to analyze this operator, we first just compute specifically what the action on our basis states is, and that can be done easily because we know these basic operators explicitly. So we get this difference of volume eigenvalues from the commutator term, and this combination of basis states at different labels from the sine square term. So that already shows us how these difference operators emerge. So that is the action on states. If we really want to write a difference equation for a state, we have to change the representation in the sense of quantum mechanics. So it's still, earlier I used the word representation and said that it was inequivalent to the Wheeler-DeWitt representation. What I mean now by representation is to transform from the connection representation in which these states were originally written to a triad representation in which we expand a general state in these eigenstates of our triad operator and view the expansion coefficients as the triad representation of the state, just what you do if you transform from the position to the momentum representation in quantum mechanics. You expand your state in the new eigenstate, and the coefficients will be the new representation of the state. That's exactly what we do here. I also write phi for a possible matter field. I don't really specialize very much these equations, but just to keep it as an additional parameter.
Let's see, you said before mu was continuous.
Yeah, for states. So
but not in this, but now you have a discrete basis or something?
Well, now the operator connects only states which are related by discrete displacements. But you can start with any mu. So mu can still be any real value. And then the whole real space is divided into lattices which are fixed by the Hamiltonian constraint.
So there's sort of a unit cell of size delta that just gets shifted by
right.
The operators?
Yeah. So this the non-separable Hilbert space that we had initially splits into sectors which are each fixed by the constraint operator.
So the constraint that came from just the Einstein action was not this one. This is the one you sort of made. I mean, you introduced the discreteness by writing your constraint.
Well, we wrote the constraint in the variables in the operators that exist on our Hilbert space. And we made sure that in the classical limit, when curvatures are small, but this reproduces the Einstein-Hilbert action. That's all that's required.
If I would write off the constraint from just quantizing the Einstein action, I would get a different C. But anyhow, in a certain way, you've put it in. And so the delta also must be is a parameter that you've chosen. I mean, that's something that is part of your...
Delta is related to the specific quantization of the constraint operator. You need to provide one operator. For each delta, maybe I should have used it as a label here, but for each delta, you get a different operator, and then, yeah.
I'm still very puzzled by this delta. It started out as a coordinate increment, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In some arbitrary coordinate system.
Well, it was, okay, it multiplied the C tilde, which is the connection component. Right, and delta times C tilde is a combination that is invariant under coordinates.
Right.
Okay, I shouldn't have called it the same, delta. So because I switched from the C tilde to the state representation here. So it's not exactly the same delta as before. It's a technical issue, and I didn't have enough space on these slides to explain what these the relation between this delta and the initial delta is. But this, we should talk about this and later on at some stage, how this delta is really, how it really occurs here. It is certainly not coordinate dependent anymore. There's an additional factor which is related to the full box that I mentioned. So the whole lattice state is in the box, and the coordinate size of the box also applies here. So let's just talk about it later on. So that's really a technical issue which requires us to go through the full construction of these models and the relation to lattice states.
I also have a question about delta. So when you argue that you get reproduce the usual classical limit, did that require delta go to zero?
No. If delta goes to zero, then the operator does not exist. The limit for the operator does not exist. It does exist for certain states. So if you simultaneously select your class of states and saying that they are sufficiently smooth, for instance, then you can reproduce. Then you can do the delta to zero limit. But and in that case, you will reproduce the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But that is only valid in these regimes where, as you can see it from the difference equation, in which psi is sufficiently smooth. So you are basically doing, you're approximating this difference operator by Taylor expanding these shifts, and then to leading order you get a second order differential operator, which happens to be the Wheeler-DeWitt operator in a certain ordering.
Yeah. So is there an argument to fix delta analogous to the argument you heard for fixing the Yersey parameter by matching the black hole entropy?
Not yet, no.
No. So at the moment it's sort of a free parameter? In the definition?
Because
the food theory
is. But in the cosmology context, the causes of what? Trying delta to
reduce it. Which one? Yeah. You can make an argument. I think it would be a heuristic argument. So you use the discreteness that we have in the full theory. We know the area spectrum, and this delta parameter was related to the Plaquette area that we have in these states. So if you say that this the area that this delta squared basically would correspond to should be the minimum that you are allowed to have from the discrete area spectrum of the full theory, then you get a certain choice for delta that you can use to construct the operator. But I mean, it's also not fully in the model because you have to refer to the full area spectrum. But I guess if at some point this relation between full operators and operators in the reduced model is better understood, then one should certainly be able to make this statement more precise and get a value for delta, or at least again, the order of magnitude that delta should have. So, I did the step quite quickly so far. So we transform to this representation. We act with our full constraint on a general state, and then just write it as an equation for all these expansion coefficients in the tried eigenstates. And that is the difference equation that we obtain. On the right-hand side, we have a quantization of the Matter-Hamiltonian. On the left-hand side, a difference operator acting on these state coefficients and certain coefficients which depend on volume eigenvalues. So this is a difference equation that was already used in some of the talks, and which is really the basis for most of these statements about singularities in loop quantum gravity. Before we discuss it, we also have to look at what's happening on the right-hand side, where I just wrote this Hamiltonian operator. It's also not completely straightforward, because in the expression for a scalar field, for instance, we again have these inverse powers of densitized riot components, which we cannot directly quantize because of the discreteness of the spectrum and the fact that zero is an eigenvalue, so there's no inverse triad operator. But since that's the same as what Thomas discussed for matter Hamiltonians, we already know how to quantize this thing in a well-defined way. So again, we write these through Poisson brackets, for which we have general expressions. This is just one that we have specifically in this isotropic model. So I just use the isotropic triad component and the isotropic connection component in those holonomies. And this equation is a classical identity. So one can just compute this Poisson bracket exactly. C and P are conjugate, so that is easy to compute. And then if the trace is taken to get rid of these Pauli matrices, the right-hand side just is identical to the left-hand side. And on the left-hand side, we don't get an immediate operator because that would be the inverse of an operator having a discrete spectrum. On the right-hand side, we have now a positive power in the Poisson bracket, so that can directly be quantized using the basic P operator that we have. Holonomies are also directly represented. The Poisson bracket again becomes a commutator, and the rest can all these, the trace and all these coefficients, summations, and taking that power can be done at the level of operator. So we do get a well-defined operator from the right-hand side.
Sorry, I mean, this is a trick which keeps being used over and over here. I mean, if this is a classical identity and the left-hand side can diverge at P over here, then the right-hand side must be able to diverge also.
Yeah.
Classically. So you're saying that when you just take this operator, when you take this quantity which can diverge classically and quantize it, it becomes finite?
Yes. So it diverges because you're taking a derivative here, and that gives you an inverse power. But if you quantize, you take a commutator. You're not taking a derivative of anything. And that is the reason why it remains finite. You can actually compute the eigenvalues explicitly, which is this expression. You get a difference from the commutator again. It's a difference a commutator of holonomies and this operator. Holonomies act by shifting the label, so that's why you get these differences of the P eigenvalues. If you look at large values of mu, large compared to delta, then you can also here expand these two expressions. You get to leading order just what you have classically. But if you go to values of mu that approach delta or even zero, then this expression remains well-defined, remains finite, and even vanishes exactly if mu is zero. Which is the place where you would have the classical divergence. So because of these commutators, and again the discreteness, because holonomies act by shifting these labels, you get well-defined expressions at the scale where the discreteness becomes important.
Right. You said the divergence is still there when is not there when delta goes to zero, or is it there? I mean, if I would take delta to zero, you would find the divergence?
The operator doesn't exist, but you could just take the eigenvalues and take delta to zero, and you would get the classical thing. Yeah.
So the finiteness is just there because you discretize things.
Well, it's because the operators we use have to take this discreteness into account. We're not discretizing; it's a classical identity, so we don't say we take this continuum derivative and then discretize it. It's the same thing. It's classically it's an identity, but then you quantize, and that gives you properties of the discretize of the quantization of the representation that turns out to be discrete. So the P spectrum now becomes important rather than just the classical P value, and that spectrum is the spectrum of a discrete operator.
But if I replace the Poisson brackets by commutators, would the identity still be true?
Well, then you quantize, and then we don't have anything for the left-hand side. You cannot even ask if the identity is true, because we can only quantize the right-hand side, not the left-hand side.
Well, then it becomes a definition.
Yeah. As always. And you start with a classical expression, and then you quantize.
Is this another ambiguity of the theory? I can imagine all sorts of classical identities I could then apply, you know, or not, and then quantize. Do I know I'm getting the same answer if I do that?
Well, again, you get, if you look at specifics, they do change. So the eigenvalues will be different for each choice. And if you compute corrections in effective equations, they would depend on the choice. In the model, you have certainly several possibilities, because the model is not very restricted. We have just a single constraint. There are no consistency conditions, for instance. But if you try to do the same things in the full theory, then the choices are much more restricted.
Ah, okay.
And so,
I have a related remedial question. Are there operator ordering issues?
Yes. So this ambiguity is like a side down operator ordering ambiguity.
Okay.
So this is there in mechanics too.
And also the difference equation that I showed depends on which ordering you choose for the Hamiltonian constraint.
And the principle you use to choose again is?
Well, you, first of all, you need to choose one. And that's then you have to see if you make a different choice, what really depends on that choice. I'm going to make a few arguments if I have time. Maybe I'll just conclude with this part about the difference equation. That will also bring us to at least one aspect of these ordering choices. So as you probably noticed, these coefficients in the triad representation just replace this wave function that we usually have in a Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. And as I mentioned, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a good approximation at large mu, and at any, and if these the wave function as a function of mu does not depend on mu strongly on the discreteness scale. So in this regime, we can expand the difference operator, and the result to leading order will be the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So that is just another way to say that this equation does have the correct classical limit. But if we go to smaller values of mu, if we approach a classical singularity, then certainly there are stronger deviations from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, because at this place the discreteness is essential. At this place, if we go to mu equals 0, we also get this new feature that we have both positive values and negative values of mu, not just positive scale factors as in a Wheeler-DeWitt quantization. So the classical singularity is no longer a boundary. It's an interior point of our mini superspace on which the wave function is defined. And so first of all, the Hilbert space itself is extended. So that is related to what was discussed earlier. Don, for instance, mentioned that one possibility to remove singularities is that the Hilbert space is extended beyond the boundary that the classical singularity would represent. And that's coming out automatically here because we use these densitized triad variables. So that already gives us an extension of the Hilbert space, because now the labels for our states also are positive or negative as eigenvalues of the densitized triad component. So that is, first of all, just a kinematical statement. So that's just a statement about how our operators are represented and what kind of stage we have. But then there's a second statement, which is really dynamical, which refers to the Hamiltonian constraint. And that is now something that is more sensitive to factor ordering. So that's a way to restrict possible choices of the factor ordering. If we look at the difference equation and view it as some kind of as a recurrence scheme for the wave function on mini superspace. So we start out with some initial values for a wave function at one side of mu, at positive mu, for instance, large values where we know that we start in a semi-classical regime. Then the difference equation, as I wrote it, allows us to uniquely extend these initial values by recurrence to values of the opposite sign of mu. So in this sense, we can evolve our state across the place on mini superspace, which classically would be singular. So that is a statement about dynamics, and that is something where factor ordering becomes more important than for the other statement that I made so far.
Are you saying that the orientation of the triad necessarily changes at a bounds?
Well, in in this transition, it's...
The orientation should be arbitrary, right? Isn't that like a gauge for us?
Well, it's only the relative orientation that changes. I mean, you start at one side, which says it corresponds to one orientation. I mean, I'm not saying that it is left or right-handed. Whether that is left or right-handed is certainly a choice that you can make. But then
if all the triads smoothly goes through zero, presumably that's what happens.
Yeah.
Right.
So here you're really going in a deep quantum regime. You're going through mu equals zero. It's not really one of these bounce pictures that have been discussed. And bounce pictures are obtained in different internal times, or maybe obtained in different internal times, and then you don't really probe on this mu equals zero regime, but some other regime, which is still might still be high energy density, but it doesn't go all the way down to a vanishing volume. So, so that's what I already mentioned. We get these two sides automatically because we use densitized triad variables, and these variables are also essential for writing a background independent representation in the full theory. So that is something that comes in by the construction of that theory. And then this extension requires a Hamiltonian constraint. So here we can probe choices that we can make there and writing down that operator. And also here there's more freedom in an exact isotropic model, but if we go to more complicated ones, that freedom is reduced because there are more consistency conditions. And what has been done so far is an isotropic model, so one can study the Kasner behavior. In that case, a similar statement remains true. So one also has a certain location of singularities on the mini superspace and a wave and a difference equation that allows one to extend the wave function through those places. It's more non-trivial because if you look at Kasner, then the solution in the metric components is very different from an isotropic solution because one of these components always diverges, and it's very different from what we have in isotropic models where all metric components are just the single one that's independent goes to zero. For Kasner, that looks different, and that might complicate the situation because that would mean that in metric variables, the singularity is at infinity. It's not at an interior point as it was here. But that's only happening in metric variables. If you write down the solution in densitized triad variables, it turns out that, again, all these triad variables go to zero. So also here, independently and much more non-trivial than in the isotropic case, the choice of these variables that we have when setting up the quantum theory becomes important also for the singularity issue, although initially, of course, it was completely unrelated. So that's the reason why even in Kasner models one can make the same argument. So Kasner singularity is resolved. And also beyond homogeneous models, these statements have been verified for spherical symmetry and other inhomogeneous models, cylindrically symmetric. So that's about half of the talk.
Okay, but, well, maybe we should, let's see, we have another talk later today. You're only about halfway through, you said?
But I think, so the rest is mainly a general statement that I wanted to make about what one could say about a more general mechanism of resolving singularity. So I could probably just go through it quickly, and if there's anybody's interested in a specific issue, we could discuss this at some maybe privately at some other time.
Okay, so we could continue maybe for another 20 minutes if you want. Or we have this Friday slot that we sort of called concluding discussion but have nothing planned to say. So if you want to take...
Can I suggest that we use that as an opportunity to hold questions until then and let Martin finish his talk? If you can do it in 20 minutes or even less now.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll try to do it quickly, and then you might choose.
I have limit questions now, and if you remember your questions for Friday, we'll have a final question.
Okay. So next three slides, I think, were intended to present a more specific model, which is isotropy, but also with a specific matter content, and provide exact solutions for the difference equation. And that also illustrates some of the properties of the discretization and the sign that are relevant for having bouncing or non-bouncing solutions. So just quickly, the model can be formulated by using the Hamiltonian, the constraint part of the Hamiltonian that we already obtained is sine squared. And one can choose variables if we have a matter field, a scalar field, which doesn't have a potential, in which the Hamiltonian and basic operators P and J, where J is just the exponential multiplied with P, form a linear algebra, and that makes the system solvable. So I'll skip details, so one can directly compute equations of motion for expectation values of the variables by using basically Heisenberg equations of motion. And because of solvability, it turns out that these expectation values of the basic variables are coupled only to each other, but not to fluctuation terms as it would usually happen. So these are equations for fluctuations, dispersions, and correlations between the basic operators. So one can write down all these equations of motion explicitly for expectation values and the dispersions and solve them because they all decouple. And that allows one to see in which case bounces occur. So here are the general solutions. And as one can see, it's not guaranteed immediately that these are always bouncing. So P is, again, related to volume. And C1 and C2 are just constants of integration from these equations of motion. So if they have opposite signs, then that would be a cinch-like solution, which is not bouncing, which approaches P equals 0. But if they have equal signs, then certainly it's a Cauchy solution, and then we do have a bounce in this model. Now, the model also tells us how to restrict these coefficients, and that's done by implementing a reality condition. So because of the definition of that operator J, we have to satisfy this relation if we want to quantize that e to the ic, which was contained in J to a unitary operator. So that condition guarantees that we have chosen a correct inner product in which that, even physically after solving the constraint equation, in which that e to the ic operator becomes unitary. And this condition, as one can see, by just implementing this for the exact solutions, implies that the product of C1 and C2, those two coefficients, is positive. So it has h squared, which is the value of the Hamiltonian, which is positive, plus C3, which come through fluctuations. So if fluctuations are small, the right-hand side is positive, and we get a Cauchy-like solution here, a bounce. But it could also happen that if we have an initial state which has large fluctuations, which is not semi-classical, for which C1 and C2 have opposite signs. So this model allows one to study what conditions are really necessary to have a bounce. It's not just the fact that we have a difference equation, that we have discreteness. Otherwise, all these solutions would have been bouncing, which is not the case. But there are additional requirements that there's at least one time, a late time, for instance, at which fluctuations are small, in which this additional term can be ignored, which allows one to conclude that the remaining solutions satisfying that condition are all bouncing. So that's just to say that it's not the case that just by using that particular representation, we automatically get bounces. There are also more physical statements that refer to properties of initial states, which are required. And that can be analyzed in more detail. So that's related to these effective equations that have been mentioned that provides a scheme to derive these effective equations, and then one can see if what perturbations, for instance, will do to the results. So that was one of the things that I wanted to mention. Maybe that was already discussed. Then I also mentioned the Kastner behavior, so that's here in more detail. Here's a relation between densitized triad components and metric components, and as I said, one of the metric components would always diverge. But the densitized triad components, which have this solution, all go to zero at the classical singularity. And if that is, that's certainly realized in the Kastner, in an exact Kastner model, if it's realized also in more general situation, then that would certainly help us to extend this singularity removal to these maybe more inhomogeneous situations. So that's an example for the difference equation, just to show it, I'm not going to discuss it, that we get for an anisotropic model. And also here, looking at this difference equation, we get a well-defined recurrence scheme, even through places where classically we would have singularities. So that has been used to also to discuss black holes. There's no time to do this. It was already mentioned at some point in some other discussion. Then maybe something that is that hasn't been mentioned yet is a possibility to treat the anisotropy here as a perturbation. So we can quantize it fully, as I showed earlier, with the difference equation on the previous slide. But we can just try to see what happens if we don't do that, if we rather treat the anisotropy as a small parameter on our on an isotropic geometry. That can be done similarly. So we start with the full difference equation. We do this Wheeler-DeWitt limit just for the anisotropy. So here we expand these difference operators in terms of differential ones. We get a mixed difference and differential equation. And the main thing, and the expressions are complicated, but the main observation is that if we do this, we get in these coefficients of the difference equation, which now become operators on the anisotropy Hilbert space, we get inverse powers of this isotropic volume variable nu bar. And it's not just evaluated at zero, because this delta 3 is a shift operator by 3. So there are coefficients in the difference equation which diverge, even not right at the classical singularity, just close to the classical singularity, but not exactly at zero volume, but at some small volume. So if we would do this perturbative quantization, we would have a difference equation that is not well defined. It has coefficients that diverge. We could not use it as a recurrence equation throughout our whole mini superspace. And that is happening, although the anisotropy quantization, in which we did not treat the anisotropy as a perturbation, was non-singular. So this is one example which shows that the non-perturbative quantization, as we use it for the discussion of singularities in those models, is really essential. And if anything is done perturbatively, it could happen that the equations become singular, although they were non-singular, non-perturbatively.
Well, you worry if the perturbative equations made sense in this case, because classically the perturbations blow up.
So yeah.
You wouldn't expect any such thing to work anyway.
Right, you wouldn't expect it to work all the way down, but and that's why I said it's not just blowing up at the singularity, it's also blowing up away from the singularity. It's not very far away, so you would still say for generic initial anisotropies, you would, and the perturbation scheme itself would lose sense before you reach the place. But there are always solutions which have initially small anisotropies, which would still be treatable as perturbations classically when you reach this point, but your quantum equation would break down there.
Well, I mean, it would lose physical sense, you know, even before it lost mathematical sense. So if you claim to get a physically sensible result from perturbation theory, in this case, I would be worried. The fact
well,
making any such claim makes me happy.
It is a mathematical statement, right? And I'm not saying it's something that happens for generic solutions, but to find solutions for which perturbation theory is still valid at this point, from a classical perspective, but the quantum equations become singular. But maybe that is some of the points, one of the points that we should discuss later on. The last remark is just about spherical symmetry, and that relates to the possibility of the BKL scenario. But also here, yeah, I can just sketch it because the difference equations become longer. So that's just a sketch of the situation. Here our reduced states are also inhomogeneous because we still have one radial direction in spherical symmetry along which the fields are inhomogeneous. So we do have different edges and vertices now. It's not like the isotropic models. And for each vertex, we have now one difference equation, because each vertex gives us an independent constraint. And these are all highly coupled, so it's a more complicated recurrence scheme. One can still show that this behavior for these boundaries and evolution through boundaries remains valid for these coupled equations. But the final point I really wanted to make is that this could also be a place where one looks at possible BKL-type arguments in a quantum gravity situation. But since these equations are, and just the type of the equation is very different from the classical ones, because these are difference equations on a MIDI superspace, it's not obvious, certainly, that the BKL arguments also apply. And so far, we haven't seen any other argument which one could use to show that, for instance, these two terms, which would be like coupling terms between these two neighboring edges, k plus and k minus, if one could argue that these wave function values of the wave function in this equation for these neighboring edges would decouple, then that would be something like a BKL argument, and one could just use a single Kasner or quantized Kasner homogeneous model to evolve just a single edge through a singularity. But so far, all